Mother Knows Death presents External Exams with Nicole and Jemmy.
Hey everyone, welcome to Mother Knows Death. Back in February on Mother Knows Death, we talked about a man who was on death row who had the first nitrogen execution. And by all accounts, this execution was botched. It was described as a horror show that lasted 22 minutes. Apparently, he was trying to pull at his restraints and was shaking so bad that he fell off of the gurney. And he was visibly breathing for 9 to 10 minutes before he looked like he wasn't suffering any longer. And I got to thinking, you know, as we progress, we're supposed to be making capital punishment more humane and less torturous to people. And I'm not exactly sure that we're achieving that. So today on our external exam, we'll be talking to an expert on medieval torture. We're going to learn about medieval torture and punishment, the brutality of different methods, and why it is clear that we no longer use those methods today. I would like to introduce you to Dr. Larissa Cat Tracy. Hi, Dr. Tracy. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks very much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Dr. Tracy is a professor of medieval literature at Longwood University in Farmville, Virginia, and she has written publications on torture and brutality in medieval literature, decapitation, which is always interesting, castration, even more interesting, wounds and wound repair, medieval and early modern murder, to name a few. And she has appeared in several National Geographic and Discovery Channel documentaries. Her work on medievalisms has been published on Salon.com, Business Insider, Elite Daily, Entertainment Weekly, The Wrap, just to name a few. So you've been all over the place, and we can't wait to find out what is so interesting about your job. So welcome. And I think the first question I'm going to ask you is just, how does one get interested in medieval literature?
I started very young with an interest in medieval literature. You can blame my parents. From the time I was a child, they read books on fantasy, and they encouraged us to read a lot of fairy tales, books like The Princess and the Goblin. I read Lord of the Rings. I read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. So that interested me in medieval literature. And then I worked in Shakespeare, and I went and did an undergraduate degree at Florida State in literature specifically. My medieval lit professors were fantastic. And I found out that there's this whole world of medieval literature that is just complex and interesting and all kinds of things going on. So I developed a degree in that. And I went to Ireland as a foreign student my last year of undergrad. And I stayed to do a master's and PhD. And I was working on female saints' lives. And that's how I got into torture.
I love that. I love hearing when people are in school and they have these teachers that just kind of blow their mind, and it changes the direction a little bit of how you're going, because they introduce you to these worlds that you didn't even know existed. Especially when we went to college, there was no internet to just Google search and look up things like that. So that's really cool that you were able to do that. So before we get started with that, like, what, when you went to Ireland, how was it living in Ireland? American, just going over there, it's really cool.
Well, like a lot of Americans, my family is of Irish extraction, is probably the best way to put it. You know, my last name's Tracy. So my dad's family has a serious Irish side to it. So I had all kinds of romantic notions when I went over there. And Ireland's very different than a lot of Americans think. But it's better, because I was there in the 90s. I left the U.S. in 1995, and I arrived kind of wet behind the ears. I was 21. And so it was a culture shock. But it was a fascinating time to be in Ireland. It was the time when the Troubles were just ending. The Good Friday Agreement was signed while I was there. And having that American view, I learned very quickly that we were wrong, that we were inaccurate. And it was more interesting to me to find out the reality of this very European city in Dublin, and a country that's really integrated into Europe, into the fabric of Europe, and isn't like the stereotype that we see of St. Patrick's Day every year. In fact, if you go to Ireland on St. Patrick's Day, you may not actually meet Irish people. You will meet Americans.
That, yeah, exactly. It's just like, it's almost a stereotype, right?
Oh, it is.
So when you were a child, you used to read all these books. So you heard of certain kinds of torture and maybe had some kind of perception of it. Once you actually learned about the reality from all of your professors and everything, did it change your initial perception on ancient torture and medieval torture?
Yes. In fact, one of the things that I do the first day of class is I ask my students, when they hear the word medieval, what do they think? And they often say torture, violence, brutality. And I tell them that's a misconception. And one of the things I learned in my research is that so much of what we think about the Middle Ages is inaccurate. And a lot of the way that popular culture presents the Middle Ages, for example, Game of Thrones, it's a medievalism and it's not reality. And a lot of the torture and brutality that shows up in films and media is based on a modern misconception. When I was 16, I read the book, The Name of the Rose by Umberto Eco, because my father said I'd hate it. In fact, my father said I wouldn't understand it. My dad, who was a very educated man, he was a naval aviator. He read the book and he said, I didn't understand it. So I don't think you'll understand it. So you can read it, but I don't think you're going to understand it. I did. It's a murder mystery. But it's also set in the backdrop of the papal inquisition, the inquisitorial powers and process. Bernard Guy is tromping through Europe with a wagon full of torture implements, and he's really this scary figure. But the reality is very different. In fact, I use a quote from Umberto Eco's book at the beginning of every chapter of Torture and Brutality, because in many ways, Umberto Eco is still challenging modern misconceptions. And the more research I did, the more I found that what we think we know about medieval torture is actually a modern conception.
That's interesting. That totally makes sense, because we're just trying to think with our 2024 brains. Yep. And it's just that happens a lot with history, actually, that things were different in that time and everyone around you was thinking differently as well. Can you give us some examples of some different kinds of torture that may be familiar ones and unfamiliar ones to us that are interesting that you think our listeners will be kind of intrigued by?
Well, this is part of the important distinction between torture and punishment in the Middle Ages, because torture was specifically designed to extract a confession before a trial, before a sentence. Punishment is what happens after you've been found guilty. So a lot of the instruments of torture that come down to us in like torture museums aren't actually torture. They weren't ever used for torture. They were used for punishment. And in a lot of cases, a lot of what you see is never existed, or it exists only in a museum, or it exists after the medieval period and the early modern period. They're more early modern than they are medieval. So I think one of the most fascinating mythologies to me is the Iron Maiden, because that was never used the way that we think it was. And the other one is the Pear of Anguish. People love that one because the Pear of Anguish looks like something that would be horrific.
All right, tell us about the Iron Maiden then. What do we perceive it to be, and what is it actually?
The Iron Maiden is kind of a central piece of like every torture museum ever. It is this iron form. It's like a big, huge box that is in the shape of a woman. And the idea is the front opens as doors, and inside the doors are spikes, or they're spikes that are mechanized and they are retractable, and you can pull them back or you can let them loose so that the person inside will be impaled with hundreds of nasty spikes. And they'll either be impaled so deeply that they'll die straight away, or they'll exsanguinate from basically death of 1,000 cuts. And it's often figured as the maiden opening her arms and embracing the criminal or the person being interrogated, and almost not crushing, but enclosing them, and then the spikes will do the rest of the nasty work. But they didn't exist.
Interesting. So that's just like, it's just kind of a myth and the name of a cool band or something.
Exactly. Well, and the Iron Maidens that did exist wouldn't have had spikes. They were like individual containment units. There were Iron Maidens, and there are a couple of late medieval examples from the 15th century. And what they were is somebody would be enclosed as a form of containment for a few hours. It would be like a solitary detention cell for a few hours, and then they'd be released. And it was a form of punishment, not torture, because they weren't trying to get you to confess to anything at that point. You'd already confessed or you'd already been judged guilty. So your punishment was a sentence of 3 or 4 hours locked in this thing, which is pretty horrific.
Yes, exactly.
Pretty dramatic, but you'd be let out. And sometimes it was done publicly with the idea of humiliation and shame. It's like a pillory where you put your head in and your hands and you stand in the square and people lob things at you. That's humiliation. That is a punishment designed to humiliate you. It also ruins your reputation. And if you ruin your reputation, then your legal standing is also affected. And that affects any other cases against you in the future. So the Iron Maiden really wasn't designed to hurt you. Psychologically, sure, but not physically.
Were there any forms of torture that were designed to physically hurt someone, and what are they, and how horrific were they, and are they still used today in some other countries, perhaps?
Yes, absolutely. One of the things about medieval torture is that the discussion about applying it starts late in the 12th century, and it's not until the Fourth Lateran Council in 1215 when torture actually gets approved by the church as an interrogation method. So before 1215, a king could order torture to elicit a confession, but he risked displeasure and unpopularity if he did. So when the church sanctions it in 1215 and priests are now allowed to use torture, they still had a prohibition against drawing blood. They weren't allowed to torture anybody in a way that would draw blood. So they had to devise torture methods that didn't make you bleed. One of the most common was the strappado. The strappado was, they would tie your hands behind your back and they would pull you up on a rope and suspend you. And it would twist your shoulders and dislocate your shoulders. You'd be suspended from a height that was enough to take you off the floor. Another way was the rack. The rack is actually a very medieval, and it was very popular, but it's not the complicated frame with all the winches and the wheels that we see in a lot of either modern torture museums. It was really simplistic until about the 14th to 15th century. The really sophisticated ones show up in the 16th century. So those racks, the basic rack would have been three poles together, a rope thrown over it, and the person would be tied like this and suspended, and weights would be attached to their feet, and the rope would be pulled so that they are suspended and pulled up, and they'd be left there hanging by their wrists until they confessed. Now, that whole point was to dislocate. It doesn't draw blood, and you could erect one anywhere. You don't need a torture chamber. You don't need somebody specifically hired to torture people. You just need a space where you can put up your frame, a rope, and somebody to pull. And depending on how long they could stand it, they could be there for hours. Now, once somebody confessed, you had to stop. That was the rule. And if you killed somebody in the act of torture, the judge became liable for that person's death. So torture is actually pretty regulated in the Middle Ages. Once it becomes part of the staple of canon law, there are rules. And there are very serious penalties if you breach those rules.
That's real. It's crazy because they're doing this terrible thing to a person. But as long as they stay within these parameters, then they're fine. It's just kind of... It reminds me... So I wrote about a case in the Gross Room a couple weeks ago called... Phalange, is that how you say it? Mm-hmm. And so that was, I came across this autopsy case from the Middle East, a more recent autopsy case where the person's feet looked very bruised on the bottom of their feet. And the point of this autopsy was to show that they dissected out the feet to show that they were true bruises underneath, like severe hemorrhaging underneath of the skin. And
not just lividity.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. So when I didn't really know about it, and I read about it and saw that they still do it to this day in certain cultures, especially in the Middle East, but it's a form of torture where they try to get information out of someone and they tie up their feet together and they slap them with like a bamboo, a stick or something, what? A whip, something like that. And at first, it's hard for me to imagine that would be painful just because I've never had it done to me. but I think that it seemed, from what I was reading, it's like one of the most painful forms of torture. It could cause all of this damage. And even if you do, I mean, you would survive from it most of the time, but it could cause permanent foot damage. And I did come across some other articles written about people who had that and survived it, and they have permanent walking disabilities because of it.
Yeah, that is a medieval torture. That was something that was done. It was also done as a means of eliciting confessions in very specific cases. It doesn't draw blood. I mean, if you can assault and beat the soles of the feet, it causes bruising, but it doesn't break the skin depending on what you use. And the whole point was to hobble people. I mean, and you're talking about agrarian cultures where people needed to be able to walk. They needed to be able to stand. And somebody could face serious and permanent disability at that point. They didn't only just beat them on the soles of their feet. Sometimes they would apply burning irons. They would apply hot irons. Because when you use a hot iron, it cauterizes the capillaries and you don't bleed. So hot irons were actually a relatively common method of torture in the Middle Ages, if it was legal to do it. Torture is illegal in England throughout the Middle Ages. So the papal inquisitors who wanted to interrogate the English Knights Templar, who were rounded up in 1307, they couldn't, because they could ask questions, but they couldn't apply torture because it was illegal in England. And they got so frustrated that there are actually letters back to the Pope asking, please, can we move these prisoners to France where we can torture them? Because we're not getting any kind of confessions. And the answer was no. And the English king, Edward II, finally allowed torture to be applied, but only if it didn't cause harm and didn't hurt them. And at that point, it was ineffective. And so the English Templars never confessed to anything, which means they were never executed. Mind you, allegedly, Edward II is murdered by being sodomized with a hot poker in 1327.
That sounds really lovely. Well, that yes. is something I was going to ask you. In your research, have you found that those torture methods are actually, I mean, not that they're right, but they were pretty effective as far as getting people to confess?
No. In fact, that's why they stopped using it. Torture actually falls out of use later in the 17th century, because after the Reformation in 1517, torture is being applied far more. So the famous scene in Pulp Fiction when Bing Rhames says, I'm going to get medieval on your ass, he really should have said, I'm going to get early modern on your ass. Because it doesn't roll off the tongue, though, because most of the torture methods that we think about come in after the Reformation, when people are being interrogated as heretics. And the 16th century is far more brutal than the Middle Ages. The 16th century use of torture is horrific, so much so that Michel de Montaigne in 1580 says, can we really condemn South American cannibals for eating the dead when we have people ripped alive and torn by dogs and racks and flames and their fellow Christians? I mean, there was this horrific response at the time, but they found that it didn't work because people would confess to anything to avoid torture. Or if they were faithful and steadfast enough, they wouldn't confess at all. And ultimately, you would end up killing them because they just wouldn't stop. And that becomes a much bigger problem. The first instance of torture in America is actually the Salem witch trials in 1692. That's the first recorded episode of torture, when Giles Corey is pressed to death. They are trying to get him to confess to witchcraft, and he won't because his wife has already confessed and been judged. And if he confesses, his children will lose all their property and all of their land. It'll go to the authorities. So he refuses to confess, and they keep piling more rocks on top of the board, on top of him, and they kill him. And it serves no purpose.
Yeah, I would. And that's going to bring me to my next question of more modern. Well, you're saying so much, I don't even know where to start. The people that get ripped apart by dogs, is that a torture thing, or that's a punishment?
That's a punishment. And what he's referring to is actually the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre of 1572, when the Catholic king, Charles IX, orders the slaughter of all the Protestants in Paris who came for the wedding of his sister Margot and Henri, the Prince of Navarre. And Charles IX was a piece of work, and his mother, Catherine de' Medici, was an even worse piece of work. And he orders the Protestants slaughtered, and 3,000 Protestants are slaughtered in the streets of Paris over the course of about a week in August of 1572. And the Catholics who did it, they sick dogs on them. They sick dogs on them. They stabbed them. They used knives. They used whatever they could. And they were happy to rip their fellow Christians apart just because.
Yeah, that's like a typical, I feel like you hear these things about religion, and that's why I'm always so skeptical to really join one, because I feel like there's a lot of history there that.
There is.
Like, just think about, I always think about this, like in 200 years from now, what are we going to be thinking about certain things we do? Well, that's one of my questions, actually. In the gross room, we were talking about circumcision a lot, especially as it relates to like religious rituals. Are there other things that you've come across that are done in the name of health or religion? Because a lot of people think, including myself, that if I had a son, I would never get them circumcised. I think that it's torture. I think that it's just barbaric at this point. But people have their own opinion on that. But do you have any examples of things like that were done in the name of religion, that besides the one you just said?
Right. Well, yeah. Circumcision was a very specifically Jewish practice in the Middle Ages. In fact, it's one of the things that is used to then levy violence against Jewish communities. It's one of the excuses for pogroms, for wiping out Jewish people, is the practice of circumcision. The Jewish authorities, the Jewish religious leaders, have very different views about blood taboos than Christians do. And of course, circumcision was one of them. But as far as religious rituals, you have self-flagellants, Christians who would beat themselves as an act of penance, and they would, to draw blood. And they would, you know, if you've seen Monty Python and you've seen the guys whacking themselves in the head, that is actually a parody of the penitentiagite, the ones who were penitent and would beat themselves as an act of penance. You also have saints who, of course, they're subjected supposedly to horrific forms of torture. And female saints, if they could withstand that torture, that made them holier. The whole point of a female saint, if they're a virgin martyr, is you torture them, they're healed, torture them, heal, torture, healed, and then they're finally executed, usually by beheading. It's kind of like Highlander. You have to cut off their head. The male saints are often executed in nasty ways. So you have the division between torture for confession and punishment, where they're executed. Things like St. Bartholomew was supposedly flayed alive. And that is something that really wasn't ever actually done, but it makes a good story. There's almost evidence.
What is flayed alive? I would like to know that. Is there descriptions of what they would say that looked like?
Oh, yes. There's skin removal. It would be removing the skin of a person while they're still alive.
Oh, my God.
So you skin an animal, you flay a human being. And that is removing the skin, either starting at the fingertips and working your way up, or you work your way down. And there's only one historical instance where they claim to have saved the skin of the person who was flayed. It's from Venice in the 15th century. And supposedly, this Venetian commander was flayed by the Turkish army, and his skin was stuffed and then kind of carried around as effigy. St. Bartholomew shows up a lot. You can always see iconography of him. Sometimes he's carrying what looks like a cloak over his arm. It's not a cloak. It's his skin. And there are other instances where people might be flayed through affliction. So there's one William de Tracy in the South English legendary, who unfortunately I believe we're related to, who murdered Thomas Becket in Canterbury Cathedral in 1170. And the South English legendary says that until he repented, he was struck with a skin affliction. And so he flayed the skin off of his arms with his nails until he repents. And then he repents, he's healed, and he dies, as you do.
I love that you just told that story, because I love that I thought it was an anatomic drawing, just because I really love all these anatomic drawings, and I know exactly which one you're talking about. And it's so cool because it's this muscular guy, like it looks like an anatomy drawing of the musculature, and he's holding his entire skin. It's so cool. I love that. And I didn't know that story. So
yeah. And sometimes that's how Bartholomew is depicted, or he might actually be wearing clothes and look whole, but still be carrying his skin. That image, that is an anatomical drawing. The one that you're talking about with the muscles and the skin, that's a 16th century anatomical drawing that's similar to the Wound Man. The Wound Man is fabulous. That's a drawing that has a male body with all the ways
that he can be wounded. That.
Yes. And, you know, like a little snake on his ankle and arrows sticking out of his arm. And it was meant to show the different ways that the human body could be penetrated or afflicted. And it was used in medical practice.
I love, those are my favorite drawings of all times. I have a lot of books that have them in there. And I just think, like, how cool life was back then. Well, I do. I just think it must have been so cool. Every week on Mother Knows Death, we talk about all of these different stories that relate to posts that we have in the Gross Room. And I think you guys would really love it if you joined. Right now, you could join for only $5.99 a month, and you get to see multiple posts a week. We have thousands of posts, pictures, videos over the course of years. When did we start the Gross Room? In
2019.
2019, yeah. And you can see all the way back. And it's just really awesome. If you have an interest in any particular topic, you could search by the title. Like I was just telling you about the guy that got impaled with the garden flag. And that is called Damage by Decoration. But you also could just search, like today I didn't remember what I called the post, so I just searched garden flag there and lawnmower. If you search lawnmower, all the lawnmower accidents will come up. So it's really awesome. And we have a great group of people in the Gross Room. So only $5.99 a month.
Yeah, so visit thegrossroom.com for more info.
Speaking of religion, Easter is coming up this weekend, and I assume that crucifixion would be considered a form of torture. Tell us everything about that. I'm so interested in it.
I like a good crucifixion, but a good crucifixion has to be done properly. And crucifixion actually wasn't torture. It was punishment. It is the judgment after. It's the sentence. Though, and this is going to blow some people's minds, crucifixion wasn't always designed to kill you, because they could take you down after about an hour. And of course, to crucify somebody, you need to do it between the radius and the ulna, right here. So all the Christian depictions of nails in the palms of your hands, it doesn't work.
You wouldn't bleed out at all. Like, no. there's nothing there. It would take a very long time.
Well, and not only that, but if you put somebody up the gravity of the body on the palms of the hands, it would just rip right through. And so if you were going to crucify somebody, you had to do it with the wrists. And you could take somebody down if you managed to miss the major veins. Take somebody down in an hour. Now, they're traumatized and it's horrific, but they are still alive. What kills Jesus is, supposedly, what kills him is the spear to the side. That's actually the killing blow, is through the ribs, is the spear to the side. And his heart is punctured. And that was because it can take you hours to die through crucifixion because your body, it's the gravity and the weight is crushing your lungs. You suffocate. And you have to be up there for hours before that happens. So if you wanted to publicly humiliate somebody and mark them because you'd have the scars, they'd know you were crucified for something, they could take you down in an hour and you could survive. And you only see that as a Roman form of punishment. It doesn't happen anywhere else, really. And it's the Romans who perfected that one.
So we're planning on planning on doing a high profile death dissection in the gross room on the crucifixion after Easter, because I'm just really curious of the anatomy and the physiology of it. So that's cool that you shared some of that. I've been thinking about it for a while, because if you hit the radial artery with a nail, it's almost like, do you ever see if you get like a nail in your tire or something, a lot of air, like some air gets out, but not a lot until you pull the nail out. And then it would be like that. And if you miss the artery completely and just hit the vein, it would just be even a slower bleed. But the further away from your heart the blood vessels get smaller and smaller, the injury would just bleed less and less, or less likely to kill you. As opposed to like your carotid artery getting sliced, you could die quickly with that. So,
right. Well, and also in crucifixion, think about the fact that his hands are over his head, because at the actual cross was not the cross that we think of like this. It was a cross like this. So far more common is this kind of cross. So someone's hands are extended over their head. So the blood flow isn't going from their heart anyway. So, you know, if somebody's wrists are cut, you put their hands over their head so they don't bleed out. So you're absolutely right. Bleeding out from crucifixion was unlikely. The cause of death, and you would know this more than I, but the cause of death is the suffocation from the weight of the body crushing your lungs.
This is also brings up an interesting point, because if you would bring someone in this case to the hospital, they would more than likely have ischemic limbs and require like bilateral arm amputations rather than bleeding out from it. So that's pretty interesting.
Absolutely. Well, and it's the same thing with the distensions from torture with the strappado and the rack, is that, you know, because you end up with those injuries that can be debilitating. Somebody can survive, but then they're no longer a productive member of society. And in a lot of cases, you wanted to make sure that they would be a productive member of society. So even pre-Lateran IV, when you have mutilation tariffs where, you know, they cut off a hand if you're a thief, or they cut off an ear, or they clip your ears, that's usually the second, third, fourth time you've done it. The fourth offense, it's not the first thing they do, because they want to make sure that people don't become a burden on their community because they can't work anymore.
So let's get into how this relates. Do you study what happens now in relation to what happened? So what, as far as torture goes, at least in America, we talked a little bit about the Middle East. They sometimes don't have as many rules as we do, but what torture methods are happening currently with the military or police that you could speak of?
Well, according to President Obama in 2009, America does not torture, according to President Obama. President Trump wanted to bring it back and thought that it should happen absolutely, unequivocally. During the Bush administration, the torture that was used was largely psychological torture, sleep deprivation, sound bombardment, but also stress positions. And actually, that's a medieval form of torture, is a stress position. So putting somebody in a hunched up form and binding their hands and their ankles so that they're almost in fetal position and cannot move for hours. In the Middle Ages, that was based on a process called the scavenger's daughter, and it's an implement that was metal bands that would hold their wrists and their ankles together, and they'd be forced into that position for hours. And just imagine if you sit in any position for any length of time, how painful that can become. And that was used quite frequently during the Iraq War and the Afghanistan War. Now, whether or not the U.S. military still engages in torture, Obama said no. President Biden followed Obama it's entirely likely that on non-American soil, you have the process of rendition. It would not surprise me if there are people who are still tortured. Waterboarding was very popular. Waterboarding, of course, simulates drowning. In many respects, it doesn't even simulate it. You're kind of drowning, and then you're released and drowning and released because the water is being poured over your face onto a cloth so you can't breathe. And waterboarding is very controversial. Any form of torture would be, but it was employed during the Iraq War and during Afghanistan and in the aftermath of 9/11. And it's possible that it still is being used by American authorities. In the Middle East, depending on the country, because not all Muslim countries involve torture. In fact, Islam prohibits it. So does Judaism to a certain extent. So this idea that it's a cultural thing, not a religious thing, when torture is used in those circumstances, in a lot of cases, it's not torture, it's just the punishment. The public beheadings are punishment. And it's because somebody has been judged, usually for minor infractions, and they've been judged guilty, and so they're executed. And the difference, of course, is the capital punishment. And honestly, beheading is a lot less horrifying than being executed with nitrogen.
Well, that's what I was saying last week. I feel like if you just shot someone in the head, or there's a lot of different things you could do to kind of end it quickly. And that's my next thing I want to talk about is I feel like it's 2024. This last execution happened and people are freaking out about it because this guy seemed to have suffered for so long before he died. But it was supposed to be done because it was more humane, but I don't know who they got that information from, because it's an asphyxia death. Like, it's not fun. Who'd they ask about that?
Yeah. Well, and the important thing to remember about capital punishment too is that capital punishment in the Middle Ages was rare. It was reserved for the worst crimes. In very much like torture, as you get into the early modern period, execution happens far more frequently. And then in the 17th and 18th century, executions happen for all kinds of minor infractions. And torture is introduced specifically to try to make sure that the person being punished is guilty. They're actually introducing torture to make sure that the person is guilty. And as soon as they figure out that that doesn't always work, they stop using it because they didn't want to execute innocent people. And the methods of execution you have in the Middle Ages, the most horrific is breaking on the wheel. That's pretty awful, because somebody was lashed to a wagon wheel and beaten until all of their limbs would be broken and their bodies would just be in pieces and they'd be on public display. That's most common in Germany in the Middle Ages. Hanging is strangulation. Because before the invention of long drop hanging in 1871, the mode of hanging, which was the most common form of capital punishment, is strangulation. They are lifted up, or they are, they're just suspended by the neck, and you are hanged by the neck until dead. And that can take 6 to 7 minutes of strangulation. And when they invent the long drop, they were trying to be more humane. In 1871, when they calculate the weight of the body and the distance you have to fall and the length of the rope so that you snap the neck, that's supposed to be more humane. That was the idea. But of course, if you get the length of the rope wrong, well, the person might not actually hang at all and they just hit the ground and they could break their legs, or their head will pop off. Because if the rope is too short, the head pops off. And that, I imagine, is fairly fast, but pretty horrific. Now, beheading could be humane if your implement is sharp and your headsman is sober and a good shot. Because this was one of the complaints about the English headsmen, and specifically in the late Middle Ages. Again, beheading was reserved for select few. It was the way that noble people who committed treason or other great crimes were executed. And there weren't many of them. It happened very rarely. In England, you would be subjected to the axe. But if your headsman wasn't sober, he might miss. Or his axe might be dull. And then he has to whack at you a few times before it severs the head. And one of the worst cases of this is the Countess of Salisbury, who was executed by Henry VIII, who was getting paranoid about his own legitimacy to the throne. And the Countess of Salisbury was 80, and she refused to kneel and put her head on the block. So the headsman had to chase her around the scaffold and hit her multiple times with the axe till she fell over and he could cut her head off.
Oh my God.
Not humane at all.
No.
Anne Boleyn specifically asks to have a swordsman from Calais brought over because the sword was sharp and he was able to do it in such a way that she would have felt nothing. In fact, when they held the head aloft and said, "Behold the head of a traitor," because she was actually convicted of something she did not do. She was convicted of adultery, witchcraft, and treason because Henry needed to get rid of her. The headsman pulls the axe out or the sword from the straw on one side. One swing, he takes her head off. Her head falls. He holds her head up and her eyes and her mouth open and shut repeatedly for about 15 seconds because it's such a clean cut. So she quite literally probably felt nothing. Now, being hanged, drawn, and quartered, which was the punishment for treason in the later Middle Ages, you are partially hanged. So you're hanged until you're partially strangled, and then they take you down. And then they lay you out, and they disembowel you while you are still alive. And then they castrate you, and then they cut off your head. And that was reserved for traitors. That was the worst possible thing that could be done. And the only thing accurate about the movie Braveheart is what they do to William Wallace at the end of that film. And he is hanged, drawn, and quartered. So when you talk about execution, if the goal is to prolong pain, you can do it. You can actually make it as horrific as you want, like hanged, drawn, and quartering. But if the idea is this is punishment that is determined by the state in legal apparatus, there was a desire to make it easy and fast. That doesn't always happen. And things like lethal injection, I mean, the reason they've stopped using it is because that is neither easy nor fast. And somebody could be very well aware of what's happening to them. And there are people who think that's perfectly fine because that then reveals the idea that it's revenge, not justice. But if you want to execute somebody painlessly, the way to do it is a firing squad or even beheading with a sword, something that's quick and something that's effective. The electric chair is horrifying. It is absolutely monstrous to watch somebody or to have somebody electrocuted to death.
Who's on the board of, I don't even know. This just got me thinking of, I guess there's this whole entire career field of people who are in charge of making these types of decisions. There's probably a whole board of people, but it seems crazy to me that a bunch of people thought like, hey, you know what? The nitrogen thing is probably the best thing to do. Like,
yeah, well, and I've got to wonder myself because, yeah, I imagine every prison, every state has different laws. So it would be state by state. You might have a state board of prisons. And then depending on the laws regarding capital punishment, you might then have a board that's responsible for determining, well, how is this state going to do it? I think it's Utah that still allows hanging, or it might allow firing squad. There are a couple places that allow condemned prisoners to actually choose to decide how they want to die.
I just was writing about this week, the Charles Lindbergh baby. I'm just like obsessed with that case right now, and talking about all of these questions are coming up now that the Richard Hauptmann, who was accused of kidnapping and murdering the baby who received the electric chair, there's all this DNA that still exists and stuff, and the state of New Jersey is very, they don't want to touch it. They don't want to test it. And the only thing I could think is because they're scared that they may have either put the wrong person to death or there's more to the story that they didn't uncover and they just want to kind of leave that alone. Because, I mean, sentencing a person to death is very significant. So I guess you really need to make sure.
You don't want to be wrong. And that's, I mean, my views on capital punishment, I'm not in favor of it because yes, there are horrific people in this world, serial killers who do awful, awful things about whose guilt there is no question. I also think that incarcerating them gives us an opportunity to learn from them. I mean, this is why we have profiling. This is why we have, you know, we have forensic psychologists who can find other serial killers because they interviewed serial killers who were alive. And in fact, Ted Bundy provided a massive amount of information that helped the FBI catch the Green River Killer. I mean, BTK profiled. All of those serial killers who were caught because they had information from other serial killers before they were either executed or before they died in prison. There are too many people who are executed who are innocent, and you can't take it back. If you execute somebody who's innocent and they're exonerated later, you can't undo it. And I testified in a murder trial when I was 18 for the defense, because a friend of mine was accused of a murder that I firmly believe, based on the forensic evidence that exists, that he did not do it. He was on death row for 2 years, and the Florida Supreme Court commuted his sentence to life in prison, and he's still in prison, again, for a crime I believe he didn't commit. But if he'd been executed, there'd be no way to know.
Yeah, and I guess he would also, you know, you just had me think of like some movie, Catch Me If You Can, right, in Frank Abagnale. And I got to see a lecture with him, and he was super cool. But he didn't murder anyone or do anything that horrific as far as that's concerned. But he was a criminal, and then he was able to help investigators for years and years and years, help find other people that were committing bank fraud and things like that. So I could see your point that it's, you know, that you would be against it because of that. I just can't help but think how I would feel if someone hurt one of my kids, especially. Like, I mean, I guess I wouldn't be for capital punishment because I'd take care of it myself, I think.
But, well, and that makes sense. And I completely understand the desire to execute people who do horrific things. The profiler who was one of the ground floor profilers for the BAU in his book, Mindhunter, he talks about being with John Glenn when they're doing Silence of the Lambs. And John Glenn was very opposed to the death penalty until John Douglas played tapes of a murder in process. And you can hear that murder being committed. And he says, well, John Glenn, or Scott Glenn, changed his views. He heard these women being murdered, and he was so horrified. He's like, that's it. I'm now in favor of the death penalty. I get that. I totally understand the desire to remove those people from the earth. I just don't know if we have a system that makes sure that it can be applied evenly and properly. And we still have a lot to learn from those people because, again, the same person who wrote Mindhunter used the interviews with those serial killers to then find and catch and stop other serial killers.
Yeah, I go back and forth. Like when you say that, I think, okay, like I feel that way. How you should you've convinced me. But then I think about, I mean, if it's not my family, I would just be like, whatever. We could learn off them. But I just don't know how I would feel in a real life situation because
that makes complete sense. And that is part of why the death penalty is such a controversial issue in this country and state by state, because unless you've experienced it, and, you know, that is not something that we would ever want to wish on anybody, to be the victim of something like that. And that kind of horrific murder and torture that happens very frequently in American society. And for some reason, almost exclusively in American society, not 100%, there have been serial killers elsewhere in the world, especially in England. Might want to ask ourselves why the UK and the US seem to have the market. We cornered the market on serial killers.
Yeah, and I guess you're saying with the torture that there was evidence that it's not really doing anything. And I've read studies that the same could be said about, I mean, like, think about states that have high death penalty that actually carry them out. They don't have a less murder rate than other states. So I guess it's not really deterrent. Like, if people want to do it, they're just like, it's impulsive. I'm doing it. I want to do this, and I'll deal with the consequences later, kind of thing.
most psychopaths and sociopaths who commit serial murder don't care what the consequence is. They don't care about the consequence. It is not the thing that would either deter them or compel them. That's one of the important things to remember about serial murders specifically, is that the psychology there, they're not thinking about what might happen to them eventually. They're thinking about what they are going to do and how they're going to do it at that moment to satisfy the need to do it. And in other cases of murder, if it's an impulsive thing, if it's a one-time thing because of anger or rage, is that really, I mean, it's horrific to lose a family member. And I know the person who was murdered in that trial I testified in. I knew her. And it was horrible what happened to her. But is it worth executing somebody in revenge for that, especially if it's the wrong person?
Yeah, I could see that. Yeah, because again, that loved one could be not just your child or your husband, wife, whatever that got murdered, but it also could be a person that's being accused and they're innocent. And you have to think of it from that perspective.
Yeah. And in the Middle Ages, they thought about that. They were actually very concerned about that. They were concerned about making sure that people who were punished were actually guilty. And a lot of people don't think that. They don't realize that in the Middle Ages, it wasn't just, you know, rape, pillage, burn, Vikings. That could be another episode to talk about Vikings and what happened with them. But it wasn't just this brutal society that was constantly ripping people apart and executing them in nasty ways and torturing them. They thought about it. And they were really trying in a lot of cases, though not always. There were abuses. There were corrupt people, just like there are now. But there were people who were really trying to make sure that if somebody was punished, they deserved it.
I love all this. Where can people hear more? Because I feel like we could hear you talk for hours about this. I know that you have a couple books and we could link them in the episode for you. But where else can people hear more of your knowledge?
Well, I have recorded a couple podcast episodes with Richard Abels on called Tis But a Scratch. And I also appear in the History Channel series Dark Marvels and The Unbelievable, hosted by Dan Aykroyd. And generally speaking, my books, Torture and Brutality in Medieval Literature, Medieval and Early Modern Murder, those are all on Amazon. Some of them appear in paperback. If we could get my book on flaying into paperback, we'd have a box set.
That'd be so cool. Well, I hope we hear a podcast from just you one day, because you're amazing. And thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you so much. And if I do have a podcast, I will invite you to be one of my first guests.
Awesome.
I promise.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Mother Knows Death. As a reminder, my training is as a pathologist assistant. I have a master's level education and specialize in anatomy and pathology education. I am not a doctor and I have not diagnosed or treated anyone, dead or alive, without the assistance of a licensed medical doctor. This show, my website, and social media accounts are designed to educate and inform people based on my experience working in pathology so they can make healthier decisions regarding their life and well-being. Always remember that science is changing every day, and the opinions expressed in this episode are based on my knowledge of those subjects at the time of publication. If you are having a medical problem, have a medical question, or are having a medical emergency, please contact your physician or visit an urgent care center, emergency room, or hospital. Please rate, review, and subscribe to Mother Knows Death on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or anywhere you get podcasts. Thanks.